From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we revisit a conversation with Issa Rae about her new HBO show, Insecure.
We wanted to just tell a story about regular people that happen to be black. Like, we didn't want to, like, hit you over the head with the fact that, oh, my God, we're black and all black issues, because we just wanted just to create something real.
That's coming up. First, though, yesterday we spoke with Democratic Senate candidate Jim Barksdale. He spoke about the influence of money in American politics.
What I'm arguing is that the balance has been upset and that the voice of the people has been not present at the table, and that the bills keep getting written to benefit large corporations that have harmed American workers.
Here are your first thoughts. Adam Dean tweets, "Thank you for your interview with Mr. Barksdale. That was the first opportunity I've had to hear him speak." And John Wilcox emailed us and said, "I wish each Senate candidate would tell us what they think could be done to reduce the extreme partisanship that we see in Washington. I know each is tempted to say, defeat my opponent and all members of his party, but that approach is futile. Neither party will ever eliminate the other party, and both parties are guilty." Well, John, we will have a chance to ask that question of Johnny Isaacson in just a moment, but we want to get your opinions on all kinds of things. So call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Incumbent U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson is expected to win a third term in this year's election. Yesterday, we spoke with his opponent, businessman and Democratic candidate Jim Barksdale. Today, we talked to Republican Isaacson about his plans should he return to Washington to represent Georgia. And Senator Isaacson joins me now. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you.
Let me put to you first that question from one of our listeners, John Wilcox, who says he wants to know what you think can be done to reduce extreme partisanship. It's no news to you that the past five or six Congresses have been among the least productive in American history, modern American history. How do we get rid of some of the partisanship in Washington?
Well, you have to work for the right goals, regardless of which parties form or who might be proposing them. And I've always tried in my career to find the best of proposals and work together with Democrats and Republicans alike to make them happen. And just for example, in the last 2 years, I've been a partner with Bob Menendez, a Democrat in New Jersey, to reform the federal flood insurance program, which was a hugely controversial issue and was partisan to begin with, but we passed with significant majorities. And I worked with the president to ratify the New START Treaty 3 years ago, which is an important move forward in terms of controlling our nuclear weapons production. So it can be done. It, like most things, what matters is your attitude.
So why have these past few Congresses been so unproductive? Why is business getting jammed up on Capitol Hill?
Well, my reason or my explanation is that this president, more than any president in the past, has used executive orders to circumvent the legislative process, and the Democrats, and although in the minority, have enough to deny cloture, have boxed the Republicans in to where there's no debate on the floor. It's all executive orders by the president and lawsuits before the Supreme Court against the president. So I think the initiation of the president to try and rule by executive order and avoid the legislative process has caused more partisanship than anything else that's happened in Washington.
So you don't feel that your party, the Republicans, have had any part in blocking business on Capitol Hill?
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay.
What I said was I thought the principal reason was the president had decided to avoid the legislative process by ruling strictly with executive order. That does not mean that all hands are not dirty. It means that that's the principal reason it's become so partisan.
So let me ask you about the Veterans Affairs Committee. That's something you've been a chairman of that committee for more than a year now. And that's an issue that for some reason our nation has struggled for some time and we haven't quite reached a place in which we're handling veterans affairs properly, either in hospitals or medical offices, or in terms of getting them the help that we need. What needs to be done?
Well, what needs to be done is there needs to be a real shakeup at the VA. Now, let me begin this answer by telling you this. There are 6.5 million veterans who get their health care through the Veterans Administration Health Services. And there are 314,000 employees in the Veterans Administration delivering those services. With numbers that big, from time to time, you're going to have staff stories to come out. The unfortunate thing is, when serving our veterans, the VA more often than not has had slips and falls in some very prominent areas. We had three suicides in the VA in Atlanta a couple of years ago, which prompted the nationwide analysis of the number of veterans committing suicide on a daily basis, which we know now is approximately 22 or 8,000 a year. And it's taken until this year for us to finally get a new hotline established so that every veteran at risk for their own life can call the phone, get a trained professional to counsel with them immediately. That was not available before. It will open up in Atlanta, Georgia in November. So that's one lagging problem that is we're about to overcome through the initiative of the Veterans Affairs Committee and the VA itself. But there are others that have to be done. We need to do a better job of seeing to it services are available to our veterans on a timely basis and no one waits too long for an appointment.
So I wanted to ask you, our listeners are tweeting in with questions that they have for
sure.
You. So we have one from Robert Jimison who says, what message does Senator Isaacson have for young minority voters who face crushing student loan debt and few good paying jobs that might help them pay off those debts?
Well, the thing I've always said and what you started this interview out by talking about why I'm running for a third term and what I intend to do. What I intend to do is see to it that every American who's qualified to get a job has a job available, and that means empowering the private sector, having incentives in government for private sector to deliver more jobs to our citizens. That's the number one way to alleviate our largest problem, which is not enough employment available for those seeking it. With that said, student debt is an issue that's gotten way out of hand. It's gotten out of hand because of a lot of folks. One is public education has raised its prices an awful lot because of the amount of credit that's available to students, and a lot of students who are borrowing money to go to school really aren't qualified or prepared to take on the debt they're taking on. But that's not something we need to blame them on. That's something we need to address and see to we structure student lending so they don't get borrowed too much over their head.
My guest is Senator Johnny Isaacson. He's a Republican running for his third term in the Senate this November. You said you wanted to empower the private sector. In what ways, what specifically does that mean?
Well, the three things I would do, number one, is manage our regulatory environment. Government has a role to see to it that competition can compete on a level playing field, but right now we're overly regulated where government's picking the winners and the losers. Business is sitting on its hands, it's sitting on capital. Our growth rate is only 1.4%. Therefore, you don't have the jobs available that you should have to move forward, and that's unfortunate. That's number one. Number two, we ought to have a tax policy that's pro-growth, that incentivizes the investment of capital in future business expansion and value-added process, not just sit on our capital and wait for somebody else to come into office. And third, and most importantly, goes back to the education question. We need to empower every single American in public schools to get a quality education and graduate with a high school diploma. And then we need to promote the STEM sort of subjects, science, technology, energy, and math, to make sure that kids are prepared for the jobs of the 21st century.
So here's another question from Ayman Hossam Fadl, listening right now, who asks, how will the war on terror end? Have you considered how we might be able to bring the war on terror to a close?
Terror on 9/11/2001 was the first battle of the ultimate war between good and evil, which probably, in a sense, will never end because terror is something one individual can inflict on another individual or on a community or on an institution at any particular time because of its very nature, and it's hard to stop it universally. But I will tell you this. Our current policy against ISIL, which is the heart and soul of terrorism, is containment. Containment is not the right policy. We need to eradicate them. We need to put troops on the ground where necessary. We need to command a force of the willing in the Middle East. We need to go after ISIL and run them away. You've got to cut the head of the snake off or you'll never stop the proliferation of terrorism.
So you have stood by an endorsement of Donald Trump. This is something that your opponent, Jim Barksdale, has focused on from time to time. Many other Republicans, including former presidents, have declined to endorse him. Why do you stand by that endorsement?
Well, first of all, he's the nominee of my party, and as I said months ago when I was interviewed on the subject, I'm going to support my ticket and support my party. My political activity is to support my reelection to the Senate because the most I can do for Georgia is as a United States Senator. I'm not a surrogate for nor a campaign manager for anybody else. I'm working for my reelection, and I support the party that I run under.
But what do you think is fueling the anger that is feeding Donald Trump's run for the president and helped to fuel Bernie Sanders' run for the nomination? I mean, I think there's no doubt that there is a sign of a simmering anger among especially middle class and working class voters in the U.S. What is behind that?
Celeste, that is a great question because that is the heart and soul of this election. Bernie Sanders on the left and Donald Trump on the right both benefited in the primaries for something I don't think either one of them really saw coming, but they caught it early, and they caught a wind at their back, and they got the Bernie almost got the nomination and probably would have had it not been for superdelegates. Trump did get the nomination, and that was a palpable anger in the American public and a frustration with an overly regulatory government, an overly bureaucratic government, and too long a period of recovery from the 08 recession. So I think both the left and the right have constituencies within their philosophy that are angry at the American government for the lack of movement forward on getting rid of overly burdensome regulation, empowering the individual, and empowering public education.
But, you know, I mean, I'm a working class voter. Regulation doesn't really inhibit my activities most of the time, but I'll tell you what does is the wage gap. And here in Georgia, we have one of the largest income inequality rates of anywhere in the country. How do you hope to bridge that gap?
Well, you know, I ran a business for 33 years, and I employed over 1,000 women at Northside Realty who were very successful. We've created opportunity and value-added process to build a real estate business and build a career and build a way to retire. I think creating jobs and opportunity is the best way to eliminate income inequality, not a government mandate for some type of formula.
Well, I'm just to push back on that. I mean, the income inequality, we're talking about the growth in a CEO salary, which in the U.S. has seen rise of like over 700% in the past, you know, couple decades, whereas regular middle class wages, in some cases, if they're adjusted for inflation, haven't risen at all. In fact, they've lost ground. So how do you address that?
There are good examples and there are bad examples, and you've talked about the bad example. Let me talk about the good example. People like Dan Amos, the president of Aflac in Columbus, Georgia, one of the largest supplemental insurance companies in the world, has put his salary up for a vote of the board of directors and put his compensation up for a vote of the stockholders. That's the type of accountability you need in corporations. Corporations are companies that are owned by their stockholders, and the CEO should not have unbridled opportunity to raise their own salary without accountability to their own stockholders. That's the way you do that.
Is you put salaries up for vote?
Well, that's what Dan Amos has done. You put it up for a vote of the stockholders, not a vote of the consumers, but a vote of the stockholders. They own the company. If you have a problem with a corporation and its policies, you go to the stockholders to change that. You don't try and change it from the outside.
That is Republican Johnny Isaacson. He's running for a third term as Georgia's U.S. Senator. And a confident senator at this point of a win?
You know, I'm never confident. I believe the choice of the voters of Georgia. What I'm trying to do is make sure that every single day of the year I'm out there doing everything I can to do the job they elected me to do, and that the election will be a ratification of me doing a good job, or if not, it'll be a ratification of someone else to replace me. I'm going to work hard to see it's me that gets reelected.
GPB will host the Atlanta Press Club debates here later this month. The U.S. Senate debate will air Sunday, October 23rd at 6 p.m. And just before that, the 3rd Congressional District debate airs at 5:30. Senator Isaacson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Celeste. Have a great day.
You too. In Georgia, native Karen Slaughter's latest novel, The Kept Woman, has just been released. We're taken to the front lines of a crime scene where there are more questions than answers. A body turns up, and the lead investigator is, of course, Will Trent of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. If you're familiar with Karen's other novels, you've probably come across that name many times before. Karen Slaughter joins me once again in our studios. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Can I just ask a question out of curiosity?
Maybe.
Do you read books digitally, or do you use the actual paper copies?
Well, you know, I've been on my tour for a couple of weeks, and when I travel, I like the digital copies. But
right.
I got home, I was in the middle of a book, so I bought the book so I could finish reading it in paper, because I guess I'm old school.
Do you prefer that people read your stuff in a paper copy versus digital? Does it matter?
It doesn't really matter. You know, there are a lot of people who just like the format. There are some people, you know, who have arthritis in their hands and can't hold a heavy book. You know, the audiobook is another great way to read it. And some people have vision problems and they don't have time to sit and read. So I think it's great no matter what they're doing.
So this book focuses on a character with, in large part, that is not well-liked. This is Will Trent's ex-wife. And this is a no-spoiler interview. But I will say that Angie, who is his ex-wife, is a big focus, probably shares equal billing to a certain extent as Will. Why?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I wrote Angie to be a polarizing character, and it's always fun for me to see the people who love her and the people who hate her, because they feel very strongly about it. And, you know, that was very by design on my part. I'm a bit alarmed, though, on my Facebook page. Sometimes I'll see readers say, oh, Will should be with Angie. And you think, boy, she's an awful person. Why would you want Will to be with Angie? I think that they just find that badness interesting.
Yeah. So I wonder, why is Georgia a particularly good place to set a crime? Is there anything about the area here? Because you have many of the thrillers are set here in Atlanta, which is a real place. And then you have, the Grant County series, when that's a fictional place. But is Georgia a good place for crime?
You know, I think so. We're not Chicago, thank goodness, but we do have a lot of people who are doing bad things. And we basically know the neighborhoods to stay out of where a lot of the bad stuff is happening. But, you know, it is a vibrant city. There's a lot going on. We've got a very diverse and a culturally diverse city here and, you know, a lot of wonderful people. But fortunately for me, we also have some bad guys.
And what's the difference in writing something that's set in a real place as opposed to setting it in like Grant County, where you can just make everything about the city up?
I wrote Grant County thinking I was being really clever and then I wouldn't get these letters about how you can't turn left on Main Street, but I still got them. I had this one guy.
Wait, yeah, seriously?
He kept writing to me saying, you can't go to Florida through Grant County. And I said, please show me on a map the route. yeah, people just want to find fault, I think. Some people do.
So it's basically this. You thought it would be different, but it isn't.
Yeah. And it's actually harder because, you know, it is an actual city, so I do try to get everything right. And then I wrote a novel called Coptown set in the 70s, and all the street names have changed since then, especially in downtown. So I had to go back and look at old maps.
So what makes thrillers such a best-selling genre? What keeps pulling us back to police procedurals and crime thrillers?
Not to sound glib, because something happens. You know, a lot of books, you read them and you think, well, what was that about? I mean, it's not even done in a clever way. It's just navel-gazing. And I think, you know, if you've Gone with the Wind, The Great Gatsby, Crime and Punishment, all of Dickens, there's some kind of crime there that propels the story. And I think it's a useful tool for a reason.
Okay, so then what makes women so good in this genre? Because, you know, in general, publishing and writing is a pretty male-dominated, even today, very male-dominated. And yet in the thriller category, we've got you. We've got Tess Gerritsen. Who else? We've got Lisa Gardner. We have a ton of women who sell millions of books in the thriller genre. Why?
I think that there are a lot of good guys out there, too, but that women know how to scare women. It just doesn't occur to men the things that terrify us. So we all know a creepy guy who we've worked with, and the guys think that he's great and just a little quirky, and the women are thinking, you know, he's probably got pieces of hair in his refrigerator that he's pulled off the floor.
My guest right now is author Karen Slaughter. Her latest novel is called The Kept Woman. And this particular novel does focus a lot on women's issues of domestic violence, issues of rape. Did you have to think strategically in how to handle those issues carefully?
Well, I always think very carefully about how I'm going to write about things, you know, what to put on the page, what to leave off. I never want to write to titillate. But someone did say, wow, you know, you're writing about an athlete and sexual assault. That's really topical. And I started writing this book a year and a half ago, and it was topical then. It's topical now because it's just something that keeps happening. You know, we have really great athletes here in Atlanta who are wonderful, and the majority of them are fantastic guys. But some of them are rapists and some of them get away with doing really bad things. And it's not a matter of being an athlete. It's just a matter of having a lot of money. And that's how society is. It's really, I hate to use the term rigged, but we really do help wealthy people along, especially in the criminal justice system.
And there is a lot of questions about morality in this novel, because there are people who justify supporting that athlete by saying, look, there's too much money at stake. I don't agree with what they're doing. It's distasteful or whatever, but there's just too much money in the balance to make this go forward.
Well, there are a lot of stakeholders in an athlete's life. And yeah, I see that to a small degree as an author. You know, I have an agent and managers and people like that who help with my career. But athletes is such a huge level, and it's such a massive amount of money for a lot of these people. And most of them have never had this kind of money. So there's a lot of people in there who are telling them the wrong things or telling them what they want to hear.
So when you're, I mean, earlier you said you don't ever want to titillate people. How do you keep that balance between shock and surprise and suspense and don't cross over into titillation?
I think every author has their own moral compass. And, you know, for me, I don't want to describe an act in a sexualized way. I want to show violence for what it is. And I think that's a fine line for some authors. I think as a woman, you know, I'm more likely to put myself in the woman's position in the scene, and I'm not going to find rape something that's really titillating. You know, it's terrifying. It's all these horrible things. And I think that capturing the emotion of that and the fear of that is much more important than writing about, you know, this happened and this happened and this happened.
Do you sometimes get inspiration from some of the real headlines that you read, or do you just try to come up with things all on your own? I mean, I guess sometimes I imagine a thriller writer sitting down and seeing a headline about a particularly either heinous or weird crime and going, okay, that's my next book right there. Does that happen?
You know, a little bit. I'm really cautious because I never want to take someone's worst awful day and put it into a book because I'm writing for entertainment. I mean, we're talking about heady things here, but really, it's a page turner. It's suspenseful. It's fun. It's entertainment. And so I don't want to feel like I'm exploiting someone. And I'll take bits and pieces. A lot of times, though, what I'll see is something so horrible and horrific that I could never put it in a book because no one would believe me.
What? You mean you find crimes that are so awful that you don't think people would find it believable?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even Anne Rule, when she wrote about
Ted
Bundy,
yeah,
she struggled a bit with that. She left some details out about things that he did because they were just too horrific.
So how do you keep up the pace? Do you end up having to schedule it like going to the gym or something? Writing, I mean. How do you keep up the pace?
You know, I do have to schedule it. I travel quite a lot. I've been on my U.S. tour, and I'm doing an event in Gwinnett tonight. So I have to make sure that I'm doing stuff for me, which is writing. I love writing. It's my passion, and that's my fun time. And so I have a cabin in North Georgia, and I go up there, and I just sequester myself and just write and write for a couple of weeks at a time. And that's really when I'm the most happy.
You need quiet.
I need quiet, absolutely.
Which you can't find in your own regular house.
Well, you know, cats can be a little intrusive.
They sit on your keyboard a lot,
they do.
Don't they?
They want attention.
Yeah. Okay. So you take like a couple weeks and you can knock out a novel. Well, you've probably been keeping notes before that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a couple of weeks at a time, you know, and it can
take
several trips up to the cabin to do this throughout the year. But like most people, my deadline is the last day of the year. So I have a very, very busy fall.
Right. Okay. So let's get back to the genre of thrillers in and of itself, because it fascinates me to a certain extent, sometimes the balance. You were talking about the difference between, say, titillation and real fear. And I wonder how you yourself arrive at that. Is your measure what scares you but doesn't disgust you? How do you find that and then make sure that that's going to be the same measure that works for your readers as well?
Well, as much as I love my readers, you know, it's been great going to libraries and bookstores these past few weeks and meeting them and talking to them. I never think about them when I'm writing. It's just me and the story. And I am a prolific reader of crime fiction, thrillers, all kinds of books, really. I'll read anything. And I write the story that I would like to read.
And that's it?
That's as simple as it is, yeah.
And when you get to the end of the book, do you then think about, gee, maybe this is too much for someone else?
You know, I don't. But it's interesting because I get a lot of readers across different generations, men and women. And I think that actually young women who grew up watching CSI and all these crime programs, and there's a real appetite for them, and they're very savvy, and they want to know the truth. And I don't take shortcuts in my book. You know, I'm not going to make up some scientific thing to make the story move more expediently. I really talk to police officers. I talk to forensics experts. I talk to medical examiners and doctors. And I want it to be as realistic as possible. That's a really important component to me of the novels. I don't want someone who's a nurse to say, wait a minute, that never happens. You know, I want it to have that realistic feel. And, you know, I think it's important and that people appreciate that. And that's, you know, obviously what they want to read.
How limiting is that, though? Are there times when you're tempted to take a shortcut?
You know, I have to honor what's going on in the medical field or whatever I'm writing about. But I think everybody understands that you can't write a textbook. You know, I had one, I asked my doctor who advises me about putting in a chest tube, and it was 16 pages, right? And I had to make it two paragraphs. So, you know, I think that they understand, but they know that I'm trying to get everything right.
So when you are coming at your characters, then what about the balance between staying what you think of as true to that particular character and also allowing them to progress and change?
That's important to me. You know, I decided a long time ago when I first started writing my Grant County books about Sarah Linton, who's in the Will Trent
series
now.
Sarah Linton, the coroner slash pediatrician.
Yes. I thought... I love serialized stories. And actually, that wasn't very popular when I first started out. I was kind of ahead of that curve. You know, you had The Sopranos, but Breaking Bad and things like that, where it's serialized and people change
right,
over the
course.
Right,
one long story told,
exactly.
Broken up into bits.
And that's how I think about the characters' journey, for lack of a better word. You know, Sarah is really affected by what she's seen. And the Sarah you meet in Blindsided, my first novel, was very different from the Sarah you meet in this Will Trent book, In the Kept Woman, because she's seen a lot of really horrible stuff. I mean, more horrible stuff than any one medical examiner would ever see, let's be honest.
Yeah.
She'd be in a mental home, right?
Yeah, honestly, people should not move to Grant County if
no,
it were real.
No, there's a reason why she left. But, you know, it is fun to see them change and grow. And I have another character, Lena Adams, who's from Grant County, and she shows up in some of the Will Trent books, and she's a very different person. You know, she's grown older. I wouldn't say she's grown wiser, but she's learned from some of her mistakes. And that was a choice on my part, is I wanted to write about the violence in context and show how it changes people.
So, I mean, we're talking about thrillers that have been turned into TV series. Is that coming down the pipeline for any of your...
I hope so. The Will Trent series has been optioned by Yellowbird. They did the Millennial series, and we're working on the script right now. And Coptown has been optioned as well, and they just found someone who's interested in being a showrunner. So it could be very exciting, or it could be nothing at all.
Now, Coptown was a standalone novel.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be just turning that, or is this the kind of thing where you might end up writing TV scripts?
Well, I would hope to eventually, and I have always wanted to write a sequel to Coptown. And I think after this book that I'm working on for next year, which is called The Good Daughter, it's another standalone, I'll definitely go back to Will Trent. But then the one after that is definitely going to be a sequel to Coptown.
What makes you want to write a sequel? Is it the characters, or is that there's still things left unresolved in stories?
It's both. You know, I love the characters in Coptown because they're just two amazing women, and they put up with a lot of crap in the 1970s and to be police officers. And I want to check in with them and follow them. And, you know, the 1970s in Atlanta was such a fascinating time. This was a tipping point for us, and we had one of the most amazing mayors in any city in maybe the world, Maynard Jackson, who really guided us through a very awful transitional time. And he kept everybody intact and kept the city whole. And I think it's amazing what he's done. And I want to talk more about that transitional time.
Now, you are probably, we only have about a minute left, but you are part of the effort to save the libraries in DeKalb. What kind of reading town or reading state, I guess, is Georgia and Atlanta? Are we a good writers and readers area?
I think we are. You know, we have some fantastic writers here. Kitty Stockett, Susan Rebecca White, Kathy Hogan Trocheck. I mean, we're really firing on all cylinders here. Kathy writes as Mary Kay Andrews. But, you know, there are huge library supporters. Every author I know is always going to say yes when a library needs help. And that's what we've done in DeKalb, and we've done that for other libraries too.
Karen Slaughter, her latest novel is called The Kept Woman. It is a page turner. She will talk about that more tonight at 7 o'clock at the Gwinnett Public Library, Speaking the Libraries. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
20-year-old Isaac Dawkins was shot and killed while driving in Floyd County, Georgia, 16 years ago. Another 20-year-old named Joey Watkins was convicted of his murder and sentenced to life in prison. But the podcast Undisclosed questions that conviction. Tomorrow we'll dig into the story with two of the show's hosts. And we want you to join us. Tell us what podcasts you listen to and love. Do you go for true crime like Undisclosed or Serial? Or maybe you like uncensored celebrity interviews or science podcasts. Call us with some recommendations at 404-500-9457 and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Issa Rae has been on a mission to prove there's no one way to be a black woman in comedy. You may have seen her popular web series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl.
Let me introduce myself. My name is Jay, and I'm awkward and black. Someone once told me those were the two worst things anyone could be.
She now has a new series on HBO called Insecure. Insecure premieres this weekend on the cable network. And I recently spoke with Issa Rae when she was in Atlanta for the Bronze Lens Film Festival. I began with a question to her about why she decided to use her real name in this series rather than a pseudonym.
You know what? If I could go back, I wouldn't, because it got really confusing. Like doing post-production, getting notes and things like that. But I just wanted to show that this was kind of a show about me and my life, not necessarily a biography, but this character was true to my essence.
But how concerned are you that fans are going to see this as a biography and going to ask you about things that happened in the show as though they happened to you?
Very concerned, because they did the same for Awkward Black Girl, and that wasn't even my name. So I just don't put it past anyone.
How do you handle that, then, if they did that when you were doing the web series as well?
I mean, I just tell them that it's not true, you know, but I wish you had asked me these questions when I first started pitching it, because I definitely didn't think ahead.
Okay. So I saw this one video that you'd posted in which you were giving advice to your younger self. I think it was called Hashtag Dear Me. And the main thing you wanted to tell your younger self was to not be concerned about whether you were black enough. Is that part of the theme of this new series as well, insecure, insecurity over what kind of black you are?
In a very subtle way. I think there's just there are preconceived notions of blackness that we want to override with this series, and I think with this character. And she, in the very opening episode, talks about how her best friend is loved by white people and black people alike, and she isn't. And I think that she may confuse that with perceptions of blackness that she doesn't fit, but she'll soon find that it's a bit more than that. But that's just something that I've always explored in my themes, in all of my work, just the different types of black people and the fact that we're not a monolith and that we have varied experiences that inform and shape us. And the character's journey to security or to confidence will lie in challenging that and asking those questions.
I mean, honestly, the opening few minutes of it have to be one of the funniest opening few minutes of any pilot ever. I mean, this is a group of, for those, I don't think I'm giving any spoilers. It's a classroom full of kids who are asking you really inappropriate questions. And one of them is like, why do you talk like a white girl?
Right.
How many of those questions have you actually gotten from a kid or otherwise?
I've got all those questions in real life.
But not like, from I don't want to say all of them.
But all of those questions have been asked to me at some point in life, either when I was a kid or by kids at some point. Yes, I can honestly say that.
They asked you what was up with your hair.
Oh, my God. Come on. Yes.
Have you gotten better at fielding those kind of things, or do people just not ask you that stuff anymore?
You definitely get asked some things, you know, but I don't get asked why I talk like a white girl at all anymore. But I mean, I think that's just more of growing up and people realizing that, okay, speaking proper English is not equated with speaking white, you know. And some of the other questions have just been, you know, I use any question that's offensive, I will turn and flip back. Like, you use humor as a defense mechanism. So that's something that I've grown to do. I will jab back and clap back quickly.
I don't want to make it seem like this show is about being black, because it seems to just be about more, at least I've seen one episode. I saw the pilot, and that one seemed to have been a more about friendship and how to be a good friend. And so how do you balance those things? And I ask that because there's so few African-American or people of color anchoring sitcoms on either on mainstream TV or on cable at all. So to a certain extent, you're a representative. And I wonder how you balance that with just wanting to put together a good storyline about human beings.
One, we wanted to just tell a story about regular people that happen to be Black. And that was first and foremost. Like, we didn't want to, like, hit you over the head with the fact that, oh, my God, we're Black and all Black issues, because that's not how Black people talk. That's not how people of color talk. Like, we just wanted to create something real at the end of the day and portray something real. And so, you know, situations arise from being a person of color, and you know, we wanted to talk about those and feature those incidents, those experiences, and again, didn't want to be didactic and be like, here's a lesson to learn from them. Just be like, okay, this is just a part of what we deal with in our day-to-day lives in a very slice-of-life show, and made sure that was the core of our storytelling. And it helps when you have a writer's room that's diverse. You have, you know, people with varied experiences who are also contributing things from their own personal lives, so it doesn't feel like we're just making stuff up at the end of the day to teach a lesson.
I wonder how easy the transition is between doing a web series where you basically have a lot of freedom, and then you're at HBO where you also have a lot of freedom. Would you have been able to reproduce this on, say, NBC?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, maybe that's one of the big advantages of doing a show on cable and on HBO specifically, which is, you know, very writer-friendly and very voice-friendly. I think that, yeah, I've always maintained that if I ever took a show to television, I wanted to be on HBO specifically for those very reasons. I don't think that I would have been able to tell the same story on any network.
Do you have censors? Do you have to get your plot lines and your writing through a board or somebody who's editing?
We deal with basically two development executives who are very, very smart. And as a team, you know, Prentice, our showrunner, we just navigate their notes, and they really help to make it better. But it's very small, which helps. And you're not going through a studio and for notes, and then a network for notes, and then, you know, dealing with advertisers and things like that. It really is streamlined with just two people, which is so refreshing.
So do you have like a list in your head of stereotypes you kind of want to address? I mean, do you think, okay, here's one thing people assume about Black people or Black women, and I want to make sure I get to this on my show. Do you have that sort of list somewhere in your subconscious?
There are some experiences that I definitely want to touch on, but for the most part, I want to make sure that the character, that anything that happens stays true to the characters that we've presented thus far. But there are definitely stories that I want to tell and things that I want to discuss and have people discuss. Yeah, there's definitely a list in the back of my mind. And that's something that I'm so proud of with this show, is that we're not like, they're inside jokes. There's a vernacular that we use. There's so many things that we don't feel the need to explain because we don't have to, you know, in the same way we make no apologies. It's very much like a bias for us, but everybody's welcome to watch type of show.
So to me, it feels surprising that I'm talking to you about this when you studied African American studies at Stanford, but it may not be. Was this sort of a goal for you all along?
What? I would like to tell my dad that. It was very disappointed that, like, hey, Dad, this was all the plan, you know. But no, I mean, you hope that, like, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted to direct and produce, but I didn't think it would come to this. You know, you hope, but I never imagined.
Issa Rae is the creator and star of the new HBO series, Insecure. It debuts Sunday night at 10:30. Issa Rae's latest show is about being young and single. It's set in L.A., but it reminded me of a conversation I had last year about being young and single in Atlanta. For women seeking men, it's rough out there, and I'm not just speaking anecdotally. The Martin Prosperity Institute analyzed census data in 2015 and found there are roughly 80,000 more single women than single men in Atlanta. That's one of the largest gaps in the country. We asked a couple of dating bloggers to talk to us about the dating scene here. Letitia Lynch is the author of Love in the A, and Brittany Manson writes about her dating life in the blog Alone in Atlanta. I spoke with them shortly after that report was released. Brittany started us off with a personal story about how Atlanta's single men-to-women ratio affects the dating scene.
So I do online dating from time to time, and one of my matches called day before yesterday to, you know, connect. And I missed his call, and I called him the next day, and he didn't remember me. And I said, you just called yesterday. He said, do you know how many people I called yesterday? So clearly he has options, and he has so many that he doesn't even have to take the time to remember who his options are, because where one falls off, another one will just pick right up. So I definitely think that there's a power shift right now, and it's in the male's favor.
What do you think, Letitia? Is there a feeling among single men that they can kind of take their pick?
I think that that is definitely a feeling that they can take their pick because they have so many options. Why should they try hard if there's just more women waiting around the corner for them? I hear guys say it all the time. I have single male friends that I always talk to them about how I feel guys are a little bit lazy with dating. They don't treat us like how the men treated women back in the day. And they're like, we don't really have to try. You know, women will still come after us whether we are really working hard or not. So, you know, why make the effort?
I can kind of sense, Brittany, every feminist eyebrow that's listening to us rising into their hairlines out there. So I want to make sure that we make it clear here that we're just talking about people who are choosing to be in the dating scene. I wonder to what extent, Brittany, are there so many single women because they're choosing to be single or focus on their career? Do you see evidence of that?
Oh, man. I don't know if I agree if people choose to be single. I think that, you know, there's a time where they do just focus on their career and they're maybe not putting as much focus on actually dating or pursuing someone, you know, to date. But I don't think anyone chooses that. You know, if it happens, they're not going to turn it away. You know, they're not going to say, oh, you know what? I'm single right now. Sorry. Like, I don't think they're going to do that.
Letitia, do you agree with that?
I kind of agree. I do feel, just speaking from experience with myself and friends of mine that are also single and in the same age category as myself, sometimes you do just want to focus on work and you aren't trying to date at all. You would rather be single for a while. You've been in a relationship. Maybe you just got out of one. It was a little bit difficult. You want to take that time to recover and really focus on yourself. Maybe part of the reason your relationship didn't work is because you weren't where you wanted to be professionally. And yes, I think some people do make the conscious effort to say, I am just going to be single. However, with the statistics, I know that that's not the case of the majority of those single women. But I do know that being in Atlanta, there are so many professional people, so many big corporations here. People are really focused on their education and pursuing their career before they're focused on getting married nowadays.
So let's dish a little bit. You guys are bloggers. Help me understand. As soon as I saw the statistic, the first thought was, wow, this is a rough town for a single woman then. Is that an accurate thought?
I mean, given the anecdote I just gave you all about the guy not remembering me, like, I think that clearly shows that it is rough for us. And I didn't know what to do. He wanted a picture of me so it could jog his memory. And he refused to carry on the conversation until I sent him this picture of me so he would know who he was talking to. So, it's definitely rough for us out here. Like, it's no way to put it, but rough.
Letitia, rough?
What's funny is that I'm such an eternal optimist. I am definitely, from my perspective, I'm definitely like the Charlotte from Sex and the City when it comes to being a single woman. I have a boyfriend now, but when I was dating, I'm like, you know what? It's fine. I never have a problem meeting anyone. And my friends are like, where are you meeting these guys? But honestly, I don't think that it's rough. I feel like if you know the type of guy that you're looking for, and I'll just give a general, I'm looking for an educated man. I hope that he's attractive. I go to networking events just for work. I meet people all the time. I'm like, he's hot, you know, he's single. I think it's just fine. I just think we have to know where to look.
But how different is all these experiences you guys are having from the experiences your parents had, for example? Oh, Brittany?
You know, when I do dish with my parents from time to time just to see, like, their thoughts on the dating scene now, and they pity us. They said, wow, you know, I can't imagine. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, the changes and the strides. I don't even know if they're considered strides when it comes to dating, but like in technology, the social media and the online dating, you know, sometimes these things can be a blessing and a curse, because with online dating, yeah, you have this catalog of people to choose from, but it also takes away the physical contact from the person and just the getting to know you, because now you can just Google someone and you can know everything that you need to know, and you can like determine within 5 seconds if you want to date them or not. You know, you don't even actually get that chance to physically interact with them anymore. And it's a difference. You know, beforehand, you know, parents, you can go to the malt shop and pick up somebody over a milkshake and that would be the end of it, you know? You know, and next thing you know, you're courting, you're dating, and you're married. Boom. And like, so, but it's not like that anymore.
Letitia, does your dating life compare with your parents?
That is funny. I'm still laughing at the malt shop. Yes, my mom and dad have been married for 29 years now. And my mom always, she and I are best friends. She talks about how she met my father and how he was like ready to get married probably within the first few months of them dating. And, you know, I hear people's parents talking about how the guy like met their father and took his time and made sure he had to, you know, come and come to the girl's house mm-hmm. and pick her up for a date and be such a gentleman. I think nowadays, you know, when I talk to my mom about my dating life, she's like, oh, my God, I couldn't put up with that, like mm-hmm. the social media. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see all this stuff about what people are doing now. You're so involved in people's lives that I feel like people don't really have to make an effort anymore to really get to know each other, because you feel like you have some false sense of knowledge of this person's life just because you've seen them on social media. Mm-hmm. So it's just it is very, very different. And my mom is so happy not to be involved in our dating world.
Letitia Lynch and Brittany Manson are bloggers in Atlanta. I spoke with them last year.